Henry Groves, Ronald J. Ellett for the appellant, and David Allen for the appellee.
Want to reserve some time?
Yes, 7 minutes, Your Honor.
7 minutes, very good. Go ahead, please.
Your Honor, I'm ready to take questions. I've assumed you read the brief. If you want to fire away.
I'll take you up on that offer. Thank you very much. I am having a little bit of trouble understanding the posture of the case. The motion below was a motion to sell. And what we have on appeal is an argument as to the substance of two non-debtor claimants, right? How do we get there? Let me back up. My understanding is that the motion that was presented was a motion to sell free and clear. And as it played out, it was primarily based on a bona fide dispute as the basis under 363F4. First question. Was it your argument that 363F4 bona fide dispute applied not only to Ms. Groves, but also to A&D's property, and that you wanted to strip off, colloquially, the deed of trust that had previously been affirmed against A&D using 363F4?
No. The decision by the court before had been to grant our requests for declaratory relief that their interest was only in half of the property, their lien. There was no decision about how much was owed on the promissory.
That's not the question. There is a deed of trust out there that had been affirmed on the prior appeal. That's there, right? So you moved to sell the property.
Yes.
You can only sell the property under one or two theories. Theory that I understood, your client to move was under 363F4.
That's not correct, because we moved under four or five theories, including the right under Arizona statute to have a partition, and we relied on a Ninth Circuit case for that.
Why would that rise in a motion to sell? You didn't bring an adversary to deny a claim. You did not bring a declaratory judgment. You didn't bring a state court action. The only thing that was presented to the court was a motion to sell,
which the court should have approved, and it did not need to reach the issue of the size of the promissory note, except for our 7,013
claim. The size of the promissory note isn't that issue at all, depending upon the vehicle by which it is presented, right? Because you argued very consistently, as I read it, 363F, there's a bona fide dispute, one, as to the issue involving Ms. Groves' property, right? And nobody disputed that. That's not on appeal. That worked fine. And then you said, well, we still need to be able to sell free and clear of A&D's lien, correct?
No, we weren't selling free and clear of their lien because we were willing to pay them. We were going to protect them, and their lien was going to attach to the proceeds.
That's sell free and clear under 363.
So the lien would attach to the proceeds, and there would need to be a determination of how big is that lien.
So the lien
absolutely attaches to the proceeds, and now the question is, whose money is it?
What's the legal theory on which you take the lien off the real property and put it on the proceeds?
Well, there were a number in the motion. One is 363F, but we also argued under other grounds of 363F.
But that's not on appeal.
No, it's not. That's why I'm a little surprised. In other words,
we're wondering why you have standing. Is the bottom line. Why does A&D have standing? A&D participated in something that was a 363H sale, which is one way to get this done. It wasn't necessarily the only way. But during the argument, toward the end, the question came up, how do we consummate this? And the answer that the bankruptcy court gave, and that I think you reluctantly agreed to, if I understood it, was we want to do the sale. And we don't have a means to affect the lien of the non-debtor entity. So the question is, if the bankruptcy court had absolutely no authority to do anything about that, why are we here?
We're here because in the adversary proceeding, all of their counterclaims were dismissed with prejudice. And then
in
the sale, those same claims were paid $237,000.
Bankruptcy court had no ability to do anything else, did it? That was a state court issue. You don't get there under 363F.
No, the bankruptcy court was the court that issued the order denying.
You're not understanding the question.
Well, the bankruptcy court was the court
Okay.
that I don't know if I'm giving a chance to answer here. The bankruptcy court was the court that entered the order denying the counterclaims with prejudice.
That's a different question.
It is a completely different question. The only thing that is before us today is an appeal from a sale motion.
Not true. There was also a second order, which was the denial of our arguments.
And where was the docket entry for that request? That came up at the end of the argument for preservation of rights. I don't even understand what that order is. And I guess to put the point on Judge Lafferty's point, why is there jurisdiction for that? Why are we considering that?
So I think there's two questions on the jurisdiction. One, is there jurisdiction over the 7013 arguments? And the bankruptcy court always has jurisdiction over its own order.
In a sale motion. You did not bring a declaratory. You did not bring a supplemental enforcement. You did not bring anything specifically addressing that. Your motion does not ask for that determination. You say, sell it free and clear under 363F4, put it aside in escrow, and let's let the court of appropriate jurisdiction, whatever that may be. That was not the relief you sought in your motion.
Wait. That is exactly the relief we said in our motion. I thought you were reciting the relief requested in the motion.
Not to decide the claim. There is nothing in the motion that originally said the compulsory argument comes up as the establishment of a bona fide dispute.
No.
You were asking them to decide. You were asking the bankruptcy court to decide that.
No. There are other grounds upon which we are entitled to sell the property, including
which you
the
have not appealed.
Right to partition, which was in the. But the order was approved selling. In other words, we're not trying to undo the sales motion. We're trying to undo the court's refusal and the award of the $237,000 to the other side. It's that portion that we're appealing, not the general sales. No, the sales closed. We're not trying to undo the sale. We're trying to undo the award of money. And I can look, we started from the premise. Either it's been waived or you need to put it aside and allow a court of competent jurisdiction. And both parties in their pleading said, we don't think you're the court of competent jurisdiction to determine whose money this is.
But you still need a legal basis on which to take the lien off the real property, right?
But we had that in the partition. We had that in the partition motion. We had it under numerous grounds under 363.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that under state partition law, there's a basis to sell free and clear of liens and have the liens attached to the proceeds?
Yes, and we cited the Ninth Circuit in the motion. We cited the Ninth Circuit case that allows that. So there really is no dispute that the sale was to happen. The sale was in everybody's interest.
Nobody. I think that's agreed. The sale wanted. The problem is traditionally under the 363 free and clear, as your motion said, you sell it free and clear attached to the proceeds. But the court didn't do that. It didn't sell it free and clear as to A&D's lien. And the lien was there. It had been just affirmed by this panel. And I think what the other judges and I are aware of is, what else could the judge have done? You wanted a substantive decision that there was no debt, correct?
That's correct, but the alternative was you set it aside until a court of competent jurisdiction makes that determination, which could have been either going back into the adversary or...
Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, that's what we asked for in the motion.
All right, but you need to bring it forward as to the appeal, because the appeal doesn't talk about any of that. But you're not asking on appeal, as I understand it, for the money to be clawed back and put into escrow pending a determination.
Well, we're challenging the award of the 237, and I think the court's got one of two things they do. We'd prefer you give it to us. But the other alternative, which we think would be appropriate, is it goes into escrow and a court of competent jurisdiction determines who gets the 237. And that may be the bankruptcy court. Although there I think we're putting a little form over substance by going back into the bankruptcy court and the adversary to refile the arguments that have already been made. That's why we're here on those arguments. But we could. You know, and I think technically that would be an appropriate ruling. But the court had no jurisdiction to determine whose 237 that was between two
problem.
Non-debtor parties.
That's exactly our problem.
Right. So if you have no jurisdiction, then you don't give it to either. You put it in and you say, look, this is...
Well, if you have no jurisdiction, you don't make an order disposing of it. You follow state law. Period. End of story. That's where we're stuck.
Okay. But the state law allows the partition and the sale. And then it allows the court to do what's appropriate with the proceeds. And then a state court judge could have made this determination between these two non-debtor parties. Mm-hmm. But still, at some point, the bankruptcy court needed to rule on our 7,013 arguments. And if the court hasn't ruled on that, we can go back and ask her to. She's going to deny it. And we can come back and appeal it again. But the 7,013, one way or another, has to be heard.
You're at 4.5 minutes.
We talked to you in your reserve time, yeah. So okay, mm-hmm. Reserve. Thank you. All right, Mr. Allen.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
The problem that we have here is, and we can kind of see it loud and clear, when Mr. Ehrlich talks about the bankruptcy court awarding $237,000 to ANS as if that's some sort of compensation or some sort of judgment that they won. That's not the case. As the court has pointed out in the prior appeal, this court affirmed, obviously ANS doesn't agree with it, but this court affirmed the prior bankruptcy court ruling saying that this is the security that ANS has in the, what we call the investment or the Rancho property. And so there's no dispute about that. There's no basis for which for A&D, who has this debt that is a secured debt, to then come in and say, hey, I want this property sold, and you can just ignore the debt and don't pay it. Just ignore it. Either give it to me or put it somewhere else, but you don't get it. There's just no basis for that.
You disagree that state partition law would allow a sale free of your client's lien of the whole property and reservation of the proceeds for subsequent determination. Are you disagreeing with Mr. Ehrlich's argument in that respect?
I do disagree with that, but that wasn't before the court. And the only argument really that I see that's being made by ANS, A&D, which is a totally specious argument, is that somehow that A&D weighed. Sorry, it's A&D and ANS is messing me up, sorry. Somehow
we're
that
the same problem, so we understand.
Excuse me. Somehow ANS waived its claim by not filing what he calls a compulsory counterclaim in response to the debt relief action. But, and I'm not, I know the court has read the brief, so I'm not going to go through all that, but there's ample authority that just is not true. And if that was true, just
how do we get there, counsel? How do we get there? That's the problem. If you establish that in the sale motion that it was appropriate to decide that, then we can get into the substance. And I understand that my problem is that the sale motion, as I understood it, referenced the bona fide dispute. And the only question before the court is whether there was a bona fide dispute.
Correct.
And charitably, the court said, no, there isn't, because there's no basis.
That is, what Your Honor said is all absolutely correct. However, the appellant is now arguing to this court is that the payment to ANS was improper because ANS had waived its debt by failing to bring a judicial foreclosure action or to sue on the debt as a counterclaim to the debt relief action. Now, if you just think about what chaos that kind of ruling would create, because what you'd have is anytime you have a debtor who wants to avoid the summary proceeding of a non-judicial foreclosure, all they would have to do is file a debt relief action challenging the debt, and according to Mr. Ehrlich, creditor would then be obligated to bring a compulsory counterclaim saying
in the 7013. I mean, this is a slightly different situation in that as a non-debtor. It's pretty clear in the 7013 that would be waived.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're correct. It is a non-debtor, so it is a different situation. But there would be no waiver of the claim by being forced to, by not following through with a judicial foreclosure. That's the point. And so here you have A&D, yeah, who owes money to ANS. That's been clearly established. Nobody's challenging it. It was never before the court as to whether that debt doesn't exist. That debt does exist. That debt's been affirmed. It was the idea of A&D and Groves to sell the property. It wasn't ANS wasn't forcing this sale. A&D was. So A&D says, hey, I want to sell the property. ANS doesn't oppose it. They say, fine, you want to sell the property, sell the property, just pay us our secured debt. And that's exactly what they did. And so I'm not sure what else really to say about it. I think it's pretty clear that there's no basis here to set that aside to the extent.
What do you think? Let's go back to our first question. So what do you understand that the court did in making its rulings on the two orders? Did it sell the property free and clear under 363 F4?
No. What the court did is it said that the property is not sold free and clear. The property is sold subject to the payoff of the lien, which is different.
Okay, so then if that's the case, then it was not sold under, the property was not sold with regard to ANS's interest under 363F then, is that correct?
Correct.
All right, and if it's not being sold under 363F4, then why reach the counterclaim issue at all? You have a pending deed of trust. Isn't that end of the story?
It is the end of the story from the point of view of, hey, if you want to sell the property, you got to pay off the loan. Otherwise, you don't sell the property, the deed of trust remains in place. And the next step would have been, had this not happened, the next step would have been a non-judicial foreclosure by ANS in order to recover its debt. That's what would have gone down. But it, like I said before, it was the idea of A&D and Rose, they said, hey, we want to sell this property. So we said, fine, you know, sell the property, but pay off our debt. And that's exactly what the court ordered. And that was the proper order. A&D doesn't even have standing really here to bring this appeal because they're not a person aggrieved under Article 3 because they weren't directly and adversely affected. They were not adversely affected by this order. They went before the order was made.
They paid a debt which they think they don't owe, right? Isn't that aggrievement?
I would say if they had a valid...
You think they're wrong about that. You think they do owe the debt, but they think they don't or shouldn't. Isn't having to pay something you don't think you should have to pay being aggrieved?
Well, because if that's their position, then they needed to, because that's a position that existed at the time that this action was filed. So if that's their position, then they should have asserted that position before they brought their own motion to sell the property. They can't have it both ways.
That's where I'm, I think, trying to get your sense of this, as I think Judge Spraker is, that, I mean, I understand they think they had theories whereby they didn't owe you the money. Those are not theories that I would have expected the bankruptcy court to be competent to decide, and I think the parties have agreed on some level that's true. So this is a funny situation where you use 363 in a situation that is not the slightest bit hostile, okay? Nobody's being forced to do anything here. A&D and the debtor want the same thing. ANS ends up wanting the same thing because they get them some money. So they use 363H as the way to get there, which is perfectly fine. But the question is, does that enable the bankruptcy court to do anything adjudicative with respect to the non-debtor interest? And my concern is, I don't see how, under that theory, the court could have done anything adjudicative, which is what gets me to agreeing in sort of a rimshot way with you. I think that at the end of the day, if the court had no ability to do anything with respect to adjudicating claims with respect to the non-debtor interest, who can be aggrieved? For example, had you gone ahead with a non-judicial foreclosure, A&D would have had every right to go to the appropriate state court and say, stop this, we've got all kinds of claims, they really don't have any debt, and let's have a hearing about it. That would have been fine. I don't know how the bankruptcy court had the power to do any of that. which leaves me in a situation where it's this weird chicken and egg, which isn't satisfying for me either, but it strikes me that, you know, I just don't know how the bankruptcy court could have done anything other than what they did. So how can anyone be aggrieved when there really was no choice at the bankruptcy court level?
But look,
you're hearing your learned counsel say, no, there was another theory here. There was this partition theory. So, you know, can you react more directly to that? If he's right, that there was another way for the bankruptcy court to get there. I'm not sure that came up. I mean, I read the transcript fairly carefully from the Sealy hearing. I didn't hear a word of that. But
yeah, I don't,
you, know, you tell me what you think about the partition theory.
Yes, Your Honor, that's my recollection also, is that there was no argument that was made along those lines. And I don't know, I mean, again, if this was a theory that counsel wanted to pursue, he could have and should have pursued it in state court and not moved for the bankruptcy court to issue an order for the sale of the property. We made our position always very clear. We said we have no objection whatsoever. I mean, he brought a motion without any evidence regarding the value. So that one we did oppose. But then he put evidence in regarding the value. He brought a second motion saying we want to sell it. This is being sold for a proper value. We came in and we said, fine, we have no objection. Just we need to get paid. And he understood that was the position. He could have stopped right then and there. If he wanted to go argue partition in the state court, he could have stopped right then and there and done that. He didn't do it. The whole question, the whole point before this panel is, did the bankruptcy court judge do something wrong? And I don't see it. I don't see what it is that this panel would say, hey, judge, you shouldn't have done this. I think the order was absolutely proper under these somewhat unusual circumstances.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mayor.
Back to you, Mr. Ellett.
Honor.
It is true that I spent quite a bit of time on my motion to sell arguing with the court's incorrect conception originally that there was not a bona fide dispute with regard to Mrs. Grove's claims. And so I had to spend a lot of time on that to get that back around, but that was not the only grounds. I cite the court to the ER record at 1824, and we say, and this is our motion to sell, 11 USC 363 F1 is satisfied because in Arizona, a co-owner of real property has the right to compel partition without regard to the preferences of other owners or claimants. And then we cited to the court in the next sentence in Copert Mine Partners LLC v. Anderson, which is a Ninth Circuit case from 2015, where a unanimous panel upheld the right in a district court to apply the Arizona statute over the objections of a co-owner.
Well, but that gets you to the sale. I understand that. That gets you the authority to approve the sale. But what I'm concerned about, where's the authority to not pay the lien holder and instead escrow the proceeds?
Well, I think that's the court has the inherent ability to determine where the money's going. The court has to make a decision about who gets how much money. And here, the decision was made based on Mr. Allen's unsupported assertion that his client was entitled to all of it. Certainly, that can't be the way we decide who gets the money. Somebody raises their hand and says, give it all to my client.
I think my point is that, you know, they had, and the lender, had a property interest. They had a lien on this property. What's the legal basis on which you take that property interest away and substitute with something else?
No. Well, you have the right to sell free and clear of interest, and you have the lien attached to the proceeds. So they still have the equivalent. What's that?
You have that right under the state partition law?
Yes.
Okay, well, what you read didn't say that. I'll go back and study your brief, but I didn't see anything saying that second part.
The other thing is the court has the inherent power when the sale order happens to determine where the money goes. The court did make a determination, gave it all to A&S Lending based on their unsupported avowal that it was theirs.
Aside from your argument about partition, which I will read as well because it doesn't make any sense to me, what is the bankruptcy court authority for disposing of property outside of, you know, recognizing there's a state law issue? How can the bankruptcy court dispose of the proceeds? I mean, what you want was to have it held, right? So you could argue with ANS about something that they think is unquestionably theirs. That was the point, wasn't it?
I didn't understand all of it, but yes, having it held, we wanted a court determination of whose money it was and how much.
Right.
And somehow in that process, because they didn't bring their claims as required by Rule 7013, they won. That can't be the right result.
No.
Well, they got all the money. I think that's winning.
No. Sorry.
No, I don't want to. You keep saying that they just gave it to them. No, there was a deed of trust. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing that stripped that deed of trust. There was no adjudication of a lack of claim. And my problem I keep coming back to is that you moved under 363F. It proceeded under F4. The court found that there was a bona fide dispute as to Ms. Grove, but clearly held that there was nothing as to ANS. So it wasn't sold free and clear under 363F4 as to ANS's deed of trust. And as Judge Lafferty keeps saying, the deed of trust tells you where to go.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't tell you how much. It doesn't tell you how much. The deed of trust doesn't say that the lender gets all the money. That's the problem. It's not that they have some claim. We're not trying to say you don't have your day to prove up your claim, but you have to present some evidence of your claim.
Okay.
The problem is not that we're not disputing they have a lien. We're disputing that they have a lien to all of the proceeds. That's our dispute.
But your dispute is that they don't get any of it because they don't have a claim.
No, they might have, if you don't accept our 9013 arguments, they might have some right when we go to court to determine how much it was. We paid on the other side, on Mrs. Grove's half, $69,000. We didn't pay the whole claim. We're not saying they don't have a lien that may be supported by some amount. And we're not saying it has to be zero. I think it's zero if you apply Rule 9013, but there still has to be a determination. It can't be just you get all of it. The lien doesn't say that they're entitled to all the sales proceeds. There is no lien that says that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. You've gone over time. I'm going to ask that you stay on the podium for just a moment to address one matter. And I find no joy in this, but I want to ask, my understanding, Mr. Allen, is that you represented Ms. Groves in the bankruptcy, correct?
Yes.
And now, and you've actually represented A&D as well, and you're here now as counsel for A&D.
Correct.
I assume that's by consent of Ms. Groves?
Yes.
Why isn't there a conflict in that you are arguing on behalf of A&D that its interest shouldn't be charged for the note, which I understand both parties are liable for?
Well, because the note for Ms. Groves has been discharged because they didn't file a proof of claim on their lien. We've paid everybody in full in that case. They did not, ANS Lending did not file their proof of claim to establish that they had any amount owing on the promissory note. So that at the beginning, every time when they should have come forward with the evidence to say, we're owed this money, no, they're not coming forward. They didn't with the proof of claim, and their claim has been adjudicated, and I am sitting, and I've been waiting for them, and I'm unfortunately, this is more the gamesmanship, for 2 months now for them to give me a release so I can give them the full amount that the bankruptcy court ordered, and they consented to $69,837.
All right. So your position is that personal debt is done and gone?
It's not my position. It's a fact based on the case. The Chapter 13 is closing,
all right,
and everybody's been paid in full.
Well, thank you for that explanation.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. Thank you for the interesting case.